Broadcast of the Economic Club of Indiana Speaker Series is made possible in part by ProLiance Energy. ProLiance, adding power to energy. Information is at ProLiance.com.
Welcome to the Economic Club of Indiana Luncheon Series. This month's speaker is the Chief Executive Officer of the Federal Reserve, Charles Evans. Evans talks about the nation's economic crisis. He says the government's $700 billion financial market rescue package and liquidity steps taken by the Fed should help unlock bank lending, but it could take some time before financial markets function in a manner that doesn't adversely affect the activities of businesses and households.
Serve as the nation's money manager, performing a vast array of functions that affect the economy, the financial system, and ultimately every U.S. resident. That's just part of the task of the Federal Reserve and of Charles L. Evans, President and Chief Executive of the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago. His duties include formulating national monetary policy, providing financial services, and regulating more than 1,100 Federal Reserve member banks in all of Iowa, most of Indiana, Illinois, Michigan, and Wisconsin. Evans has been with the Chicago Federal Reserve for more than 17 years. He was named to his current post as the ninth president in September of 2007. Previously, he was the director of research and a senior vice president. In addition to his work at the Federal Reserve, Evans has taught at the University of Chicago, University of Michigan, and University of South Carolina. Mr. Evans says financial turmoil and weakening housing markets are not the only factors weighing on economic activity. Economic growth has slowed with substantial increases in food and energy costs, which reduces the purchasing power of families and increases costs for companies. Mr. Evans' speech today is titled Discussion on the Current Economy, and I'm certain that that will indeed be most appropriate in midst of these most extraordinarily turbulent times, as he says. He believes that the federal economic policies enacted in recent months will move the country toward financial stability, and I, like each of you, look forward to hearing his remarks. Please join me in a warm Indiana Economic Club reception for Charles Evans.
Thanks, Steve. Thanks very much for that kind introduction. And thanks to the Economic Club of Indiana for inviting me today. I'm delighted to be here to share my thoughts on the economy during this challenging period. And I'd like to offer a special thanks to Ann Mertlow, one of our directors at the Chicago Fed. She's been with us for a little while now, and she's been providing really valuable information on the state of the economy in our district in this area and offering her insights as well. This information is helpful. Not only it helps us gauge the local economies within the 7th District, but it also contributes to our understanding of developments in the national economy. After all, monetary policy is national, and so that's what's really key. And I'm not sure if we described precisely to you when we recruited you to the board, but one of the tasks is to review the discount rate every 2 weeks. And so there's a tremendous amount of effort involved, and we had a conversation just yesterday about that. It's very important. So thanks so much. Today I will discuss the recent events in financial markets and the Federal Reserve's responses to them. I'll also give my take on the current economic outlook. And as always, if you've ever seen a Fed official, I'm here to tell you that these are my thoughts only, and not those of my colleagues in the Federal Reserve System, so you can't hold them against them. You know, lately I've had to be especially careful to turn off my phone. My brother's a small businessman with a business loan tied to LIBOR, and he has an obnoxious habit of calling me at the wrong time. So I think I've taken care of that. Let me begin with the financial crisis. Over the past year, we've witnessed the deteriorating performance of mortgages and a broad array of mortgage-backed securities, some of which, as you know, are highly structured instruments with opaque risk profiles. The problems in mortgages have spilled over to other segments of our financial markets. Market participants have reassessed the risk profiles of other complex securities, and the prices of these assets have declined as well. This cascading process of repricing has had a detrimental impact on the liquidity and capital positions of a wide range of financial institutions in the United States and around the world. The resulting disruptions to financial markets have made credit more costly and more difficult to obtain for many households and businesses. Banks are reluctant to lend even to one another because of concerns over counterparty risk, the desire to preserve liquidity, and limited balance sheet capacity. This has resulted in large increases between the London Interbank Offered Rate, or LIBOR, and the federal funds rate. LIBOR, of course, is a common benchmark for the interest rate charged on short-term interbank lending. Many banks set their interest rates on loans to households and businesses as a markup over their cost of funds, as measured by LIBOR. Increases in LIBOR, no doubt, have translated into the higher borrowing rates for those of you operating a business today, as I just mentioned. Before this financial turmoil began, the 30-day LIBOR rate typically hovered around 10 basis points above the level of the federal funds rate that would be expected to prevail over the term of the loan. Since the summer of 2007, the spread has risen substantially, averaging about 50 basis points higher between August 2007 and August 2008. Of course, since then, we've had some spikes of greater amount for some period of time. Strains on financial institutions have also spilled over to other markets, like that for commercial paper. Because of concerns over their ability to meet future payments, some financial services firms have had difficulty rolling over commercial paper. They've seen their cost of issuing paper rise substantially. These difficulties are also affecting the availability and cost of commercial paper funding to non-financial firms. Non-financial firms often issue commercial paper to fund regular operations, such as meeting payrolls and buying materials. In addition, finance companies issue commercial paper to support leasing and to extend credit to non-financial customers, such as in the provision of car loans and the financing of inventories. The tightening of credit conditions has weighed on spending by households and businesses. Their spending capacity was also reduced by the protracted weakness in housing markets, along with earlier increases in prices for energy and other commodities. As a result, aggregate economic activity edged down in the third quarter and has since deteriorated to the point that the U.S. economy is now clearly in the midst of a substantial downturn. Over the past couple of months, we have witnessed another wave of large-scale disruptions to the financial services industry. These recent developments reflect a confluence of factors. As we move through the summer, the financial system faced increasing difficulties owing to further deterioration of the economy. Consumption began to contract noticeably, and labor markets declined at an accelerating pace. The weakness in economic activity intensified the strains on banks, since not only mortgage loans, but also business, car, and credit card loans started to exhibit higher default risks. The deteriorating credit risks led banks to hold on to liquid assets even more and to tighten credit standards even further. At the same time that the macroeconomic picture was deteriorating, a number of large financial firms were reporting severe losses. Some institutions, notably Wachovia, Washington Mutual, and Merrill Lynch, appeared unable to survive on their own and were purchased by large banks. However, the losses at Lehman Brothers were especially large, and a buyer could not be found. Consequently, Lehman had to declare bankruptcy. At almost the same time, American International Group, AIG, one of the most important insurers of credit default insurance, found itself unable to meet its liabilities. The Federal Reserve engineered a loan on difficult terms to AIG in order to avoid substantial further unraveling. These developments dealt a serious blow to market confidence. The problems in these major institutions intensified financial market participants' concerns about the ability of their counterparties to repay debt. This heightened assessment of risk resulted in funding becoming even more difficult and expensive to obtain across a spectrum of markets. In the interbank market, LIBOR spread spiked up again, jumping briefly to as high as 335 basis points. This, of course, made many types of bank loans even more expensive. Banks also further tightened their credit standards for new lending to both businesses and households. In credit markets, concerns about the loss exposure of even normally highly rated firms led to a fall in value of a wide range of debt instruments and derivative products. In commercial paper, this was reflected in a spike in rates for many issues, particularly those for asset-backed securities and the paper of lower-rated non-financial firms. Furthermore, the problems in the commercial paper and other short-term lending markets continued to spread following the initial shock. In part, this reflected a feedback loop between these markets and the money market mutual funds. Money market funds hold commercial paper and engage in repurchase agreements with highly rated firms. Money market mutual funds that held Lehman or other now distressed paper were exposed to potentially significant losses. Indeed, the reserve primary fund ended up breaking the buck, meaning its net asset value per share dropped below $1 after suffering losses on its holdings of Lehman debt. As a result of such losses, many investors began redeeming funds from money market accounts or shifting funds into treasury-only accounts. To meet the redemptions, many money market funds had to liquidate assets into an already depressed market. In addition, other commercial paper was downgraded and became ineligible to be purchased by money market mutual funds, exerting further downward pressure on this market. As perceived price risk and redemption risk increased dramatically, there was a marked reduction in the maturity of commercial paper and other debt being rolled through the markets. As a consequence of these pressures, even some highly rated firms found it more difficult and expensive to obtain short-term financing through the commercial paper and repo markets. Some of these firms have been able to tap bank backup lines of credit. But this substitution just pushes the money market difficulties back into the banking system. The drawdowns of existing bank revolvers and credit lines increase the size of banks' balance sheets at a time when they are trying to reduce leverage. Thus, they potentially squeeze out the ability of banks to make other loans. This is similar to how the redemptions by the money market fund's customers reduce the fund's capacity to invest in commercial paper that non-financial firms then use to fund operations. Now, the Fed has implemented a number of policy responses to these extraordinary events aimed at mitigating the problems in the financial system and their potential fallout on the spending and production capacity of the rest of the economy. First, the Fed turned to its traditional monetary policy instruments, that is, to reductions in the federal funds rate and the discount rate. In August 2007, the Fed reduced the spread of the discount rate over the federal funds rate from its normal 100 basis points to only 50 basis points. And last March, it was reduced further to 25 basis points. The first funds rate cut occurred in September 2007. The initial moves during the fall of 2007 were measured, but eventually gave way to more aggressive rate cuts. Today, the funds rate is 1%, 425 basis points lower than when we started these reductions. Although the corresponding injections of liquidity into the overnight interbank market have reduced restrictive credit conditions somewhat, it became clear early on that further and alternative extensions of central bank liquidity would be necessary to restore adequate interbank lending at term and further facilitate market functioning. Even in normal times, the discount window at the Fed is available to sound depository institutions in order to smooth out payment difficulties. Such lending can also help the flow of credit in interbank markets more generally. And as early as the fall of 2007, the Fed made a number of substantial changes to the operation of the window to encourage its use. One change was increasing the maximum term of the loans to up to 90 days. Traditionally, borrowing at the window was overnight or very short term. And since these changes have been made, we have seen a large increase in lending to depository institutions. Earlier this year, new market dysfunctions emerged, like the collapse of the auction rate security market, and then the sudden demise of Bear Stearns last March. These episodes clearly indicated that in this strained environment, financial market participants, other than depository institutions, might face liquidity shortfalls that could have serious, far-ranging repercussions for the economy. This led the Fed to create a number of facilities to directly provide liquidity to non-depository institutions. The Federal Reserve Act grants us such emergency powers when the economy is faced with these unusual and exigent circumstances. And in particular, it requires a supermajority of the governors in order to invoke these very extraordinary circumstances, and they are by definition temporary, but they could last some time. Now, at first, these measures were aimed at lending to broker-dealers who engage in securities transactions with the Fed and who have a large-scale presence in the repo and other short-term funding markets. Most recently, we have introduced new lending facilities to help work through the disruptions in the money market mutual fund and commercial paper markets. These programs provide a liquidity backstop for commercial paper and facilitate the sale in secondary markets of a number of instruments held by money market funds. Although it is still early, I am hopeful that these programs will have substantial positive effects on restoring liquidity in the short-term financing market. Indeed, the spreads between commercial paper and the Fed funds rate have fallen, retracing most of the run-up that occurred in mid-September. Still, it's probably too early to say that things are back to anything like normal. Of course, the Federal Reserve has not been dealing with the crisis in a vacuum. Congress also responded by enacting the Emergency Economic Stabilization Act. As part of the act, the Treasury has injected significant capital into the banking system. In addition, deposit insurance limits have been increased, and the FDIC has put in place special facilities to insure other liabilities of depository institutions, especially senior unsecured debt. I believe that together, the actions by the Fed and the other branches of government will help unlock lending capacity and will move us toward financial stability. But it will not be an easy process, and it could take some time before financial markets function in a manner that does not impinge on the activities of businesses and households. So that brings me to recent developments in the non-financial sectors of the economy and the outlook for the next few years. Over the past year, the U.S. economy has been slowing, and in the third quarter, GDP fell at an annual rate of 0.3%. Payrolls, which had been declining slowly since December 2007, fell sharply in September and October, bringing the year-to-date job losses to 1.2 million. There's also been a sharp rise in the unemployment rate. In October, it reached 6.5%. Weak labor markets and rising consumer prices have held back growth in real incomes. These, along with the financial strains, have led to marked weakness in business investment, industrial production, and consumer spending. Indeed, the declines in consumer spending over the past few months have been very large, on par with the drops experienced during the 1990 and the 1982 recessions. So currently, aggregate economic activity is contracting. At this time, it is very difficult to judge how long the downturn might last and how deep it ultimately will be. As financial markets work through these problems with important help from government policy, and as credit flows improve, we should see a return of growth in spending, production, and employment. But given the magnitudes of the problems that we face, we could see activity remaining quite sluggish through much of 2009. This thinking shaped the forecast that I submitted at our most recent Federal Open Market Committee meeting on October 28th and 29th. At that time, the central tendency of the forecast of the governors and Reserve Bank presidents for GDP growth for 2008 as a whole was in a range of 0 to 0.3%, which is about zero. Given that GDP growth averaged a bit under 2% in the first half of the year, well, you can do the math. These forecasts imply a noticeable decline in real GDP in the second half of the year. The math would translate into about minus 1.2 to minus 1.8% in the second half of the year. And the third quarter was only a 0.3 decline, so the fourth quarter is forecast to be a substantial decline. In explaining these forecasts, many participants noted the weakening data on consumer spending, stock market wealth, consumer confidence, and labor market conditions, as well as the severe dislocations in credit markets. These factors were expected to weigh heavily on household and business spending in 2008 and persist to some degree in 2009. Furthermore, weakness abroad was expected to hold back growth in exports. Earlier this year, we sort of benefited, and last year we benefited from the fact that net export growth was quite strong and added to growth because the foreign economies were doing well. But now that's not the situation. So participants were looking for a relatively gradual recovery, with most of the forecasts for 2009 being somewhere between a 0.25% decline to a very small 1% increase in real GDP. That's for 2009. The recovery is expected to take hold more firmly and noticeably in 2010 and beyond. In this growth environment, most forecasts had the unemployment rate rising to between 7.1 and 7.6% by the fourth quarter of 2009, before it begins to edge down to 5.5 to between 5.5 and 6.5% by the end of 2011. Such unemployment rates would mean that a substantial degree of resource slack would remain in the economy over the next few years. This slack, along with the recent declines in the prices of energy and other commodities, should clearly bring down inflation. Increases in the price index for total personal consumption expenditures were projected to move from the 2.75 to 3% range in 2008 to lower rates of between 1.4 and 1.7% in 2011. And so to me, these, you know, lower numbers are much more consistent with price stability, and if in fact they're a little bit on the low side of most measures of price stability. When submitting these forecasts, the committee members also noted that the degree of uncertainty about the outlook was unusually high. In large part, this reflects the wide range of possible outcomes for the financial crisis and the associated interactions with the real economy. Now, personally, I thought it was easier to envision the bad outcome scenarios than the good ones, and most of my colleagues tended to agree. So we viewed the risk to the forecast as being skewed to the downside. Indeed, since these projections were made, the incoming data, particularly on consumer spending and labor market conditions, have been weaker than I had expected. That said, not all of the news has been bad. The prices for energy and other commodities have come down further. And as I mentioned earlier, we have seen some declines in spreads on interbank borrowing rates and the commercial paper market. I'm hopeful that we will see continued improvement in financial market functioning and that this will show through and improve credit terms for households and non-financial businesses. But as I noted earlier, it likely will be a while before markets are functioning in a manner that we would characterize as smooth and efficient. So to conclude, the U.S. economy continues to face many challenges. The Fed has been proactive in addressing market liquidity stress during the financial crisis, first by using our monetary policy tools, and later through our improvised lending facilities in response to financial market developments. Moving forward, it is important that we be vigilant in monitoring the risk to growth, as well as any risk to the prospects for obtaining price stability. It is also important for us to continue to collaborate with global policymakers in the pursuit of financial stability worldwide. We likely are in for a protracted period of poor economic performance. But the policy actions taken by the Fed and other government agencies over the course of the financial crisis and the effort of the private sector to work through their difficulties will eventually help support a recovery in economic growth. Thank you very much for your attention.
We do have a good group of questions here for you, Mr. Evans. First of all, play Monday morning quarterback, and as we look at what's happened over the last 6 or 8 weeks, would have been better if we would have let the free market run its course, and if we had, what potentially might have been the outcome?
So I guess we'd have to have a discussion about what letting the free market run its course means. So we, you know, in some sense did that with the demise of Lehman Brothers and them declaring bankruptcy. I think that the problem after that with AIG was that they provided a lot of insurance on the credit default swap side, and that with the failure of Lehman Brothers, that if they had not been able to perform on that, if they didn't have the liquidity to meet that, we would have had even more distress. It's clearly the case that during this entire process, there's been a struggle with the valuation of mortgage-related assets and transparency. A lot of these very complicated assets, the CDOs and the CDO squares, are rather opaque, that people relied on the rating agencies to tell them that they were AAA and they did not perform up to most people's expectations of AAA, certainly as they relate to corporate bonds. And that we've been struggling to see what the right, what the market valuation is on these, and because the liquidity concerns have been so great, there has been a perceived discrepancy between what the market price of these distressed assets is today, if you have to sell at fire sale prices, versus if you had the capacity to hold these assets to term and not suffer through the liquidity penalty of having to sell there. So, you know, so presumably a free market type approach would have demanded more of the rapid sale into this liquidity difficulties. And, you know, that just seems like a very challenging way to go. One of the roles of a central bank is to provide liquidity to the financial system when it is, you know, to institutions which are solvent. We provide liquidity against good collateral, and, you know, that is valued at market prices, and then we apply a haircut to that. So we have to have the credit secured to our satisfaction. That's how we've approached this. So, you know, I'm hopeful that that's the best approach.
Thank you. Which D word scares you more, deflation or depression, and why?
I guess it goes without saying that both of those D words are scary. That's not a very good, that must be a, yeah, I don't even have the right analogy in place there. I think, you know, obviously when the economy is undergoing a dramatic downturn like we are today, and so many people are thrown out of employment, the unemployment rolls grow, that is a tremendous wasted resource to the economy and to our country and abroad, and whatever actions that were reasonable that we could take in order to forsake that type of sacrifice would be beneficial. One thing that's very important during difficulties like this is we know that there's a tremendous amount of leverage out there in financial markets, and we're going through a period where markets have to de-lever, and that's very painful. What we try to do is maintain market functioning so that we have an orderly deleveraging process. And, you know, it's up for grabs as to whether or not anybody would describe what we're seeing as orderly here. But we're trying to improve that as best we can. One of the real dangers, and something that happened during the Great Depression, is that when a market overshoots, you could permanently impair the productive capabilities of the credit origination process, and hence lending and the ability of the economy to grow. And so any avoidable destruction of wealth and productive capacity is something that has to be very important in thinking about policy. And so, you know, that's why we've taken the actions that we've had in order to avoid the type of D word that you're suggesting here in terms of depression. In terms of deflation, I think that, you know, as a couple of other policymakers have responded recently, with respect to this type of question, I do not place much. So I would say that the risks of deflation are certainly higher than what I thought 5 months ago, when I was a little more concerned about inflation, as commodity and energy prices were so high, and I was worried that inflationary expectations would begin to rise. We're clearly not in that type of situation. So obviously, the likelihood of that type of event is higher, but I think it's still small at the moment. I think we're going to undergo a period of disinflation, and that is a reduction in the inflation rate along the lines of what the committee forecasted as its central tendency around the 1.5% range within a couple of years. But things are transpiring even more quickly than we could have anticipated just a few weeks ago. So there's a tremendous amount of uncertainty.
Following along on the line of deflation, even though there's some concern about that now, what's the long-term possibility for inflation given the fact that $1 trillion has been quickly invested into the economy?
So it's certainly the case that with all of the Federal Reserve lending facilities and also the appropriation of the funds to support the Treasury's TARP program, that the Federal Reserve balance sheet has been increased dramatically from $800 billion not so long ago to over $2 trillion, and then with the TARP money and anything else that comes after that. There is a tremendous amount of liquidity that has been provided out into the financial market sector. The way that we conduct monetary policy is that we target the federal funds rate, and it's currently targeted at 1%. So when there's this amount of liquidity out there, the folks in at the New York Fed who are charged with hitting the funds rate target have to work hard to sterilize any excess funds, which might lead to a lower federal funds rate than our target. So for some period of time, we've been undershooting our federal funds rate. That's excess liquidity, and that's why those interest rates are very low. We are undertaking some actions to address that, such as providing interest on reserves and some other actions. But this does sort of call to mind the fact that with so much liquidity out there, if all of a sudden the economy were to take off very quickly, you know, we'd want to bring that liquidity back and take it out of the economy. And at the moment, I'm not concerned about that last case. Fortunately, I would be very happy to address that at the appropriate time, and could only hope that it comes sooner rather than later.
Thanks. Question here about what industries are best positioned to weather or even benefit out of the current economic environment.
I think this is a very challenging time. I'm hard-pressed to think of any particular industry that has a tremendous advantage over others. I mean, it's certainly the case that in downturns like this, manufacturing tends to be more volatile than other industries, and so during the good times, they do better. During the worst times, they do worse, and we're, you know, in the down part of that cycle, so they're a bit more challenged. But it has been extraordinary the way that the difficulties that became first evident, although the seeds could have been sown longer ago. I think that, you know, as housing started to turn down and begin to noticeably subtract percentage points off of GDP growth, the economy continued to do quite well outside of that area for some period of time, in part because net exports were high. We were exporting a lot. And manufacturing was doing well in some cases, but it is at the point now where this is affecting every industry and every sector of the economy. So, I think we're all going to be challenged by this for quite some time.
Kind of a insider's question here. Can you give us some perhaps not so typical or things that we wouldn't notice that may be indicators that we're going to go back up in the right direction? I mean, what were the types of things that you look, some of the nuances, if you will?
Well, I think some of the typical indicators that you would expect to see would be if the financial markets began to function somewhat better, if some of these risk spreads came down, if bank lending began to improve substantially. I think that some of the less obvious indicators might be on the housing side. We've seen as the housing difficulties began, you know, it seems clear, certainly in hindsight, that there were hot markets where house prices had increased dramatically on the West Coast, in Phoenix and Las Vegas, Florida, other hot areas, and that seemed unsustainable, and in fact, those prices began to come down. At first, it was a regional problem, and so, as my predecessor liked to say, at a particular time when this was appropriate, you know, this is sort of a Las Vegas problem. And as we know, what takes place in Las Vegas stays in Las Vegas. the housing difficulties there, it was regionally contained. Then it became national, and, you know, national housing prices began to fall. And so I think things will be a little better off when we you know, sort of detach again, and it becomes more of a regional problem where there are, you know, imbalances in some places, but not more nationally as the inventory of unsold homes seems to be at the moment. I think you can probably drive around many, many two communities in the United States and see many, many two houses for sale which have been on the market for quite some time. When that becomes just a regional problem, that would be one sign that we're better.
Another kind of technical question, and I think there's some question about what the funds are being used for, but what – it's your brother calling for you. Credit that joke over there. I heard that one. In the future, what percent of leverage should banks and investment banks have to provide economic growth and yet not create excessive risk?
So I think that, you know, we've clearly gone through a period where credit was – you know, a couple of years ago, credit was readily available. It was extended on very generous terms, that the risk premiums associated with that type of lending were almost non-existent. We would hear stories from a wide number of people about how it was easy to get loans that had no covenants, that, you know, you didn't have to pay principal. You could just extend the maturity, put it into principal. And you know, those just didn't seem to be very prudent, although they seemed to be the competitive conditions that prevailed at the time. So it's clear that we're going to need much more prudent lending and backed by a sufficient amount of capital, that a number of the larger banks had aggressive programs where they would take assets and they would put them off balance sheet so they didn't have to hold as much capital against them. And while, you know, that's not a great policy, if those had been higher, well, I can't say higher rated assets because they were mostly AAA assets, but if they had ended up doing better, then, but there was more risk embodied in that, and then they brought them back onto their balance sheet. So I think we're going to have to be much more careful about knowing how to allocate capital to all of these parts of the balance sheet, both on and off, and we're headed for a period where we're going to be much more vigilant on that, I'm sure.
Treasury Secretary Paulson says that their shifting approaches represent their adjusting to rapidly changing events. Is he being wisely flexible, or is he really lacking a game plan? I don't write them, I just read them.
I think it's been an extraordinarily challenging time to try to devise the appropriate policies and lending facilities and capital injection programs that would have the highest probability of effectively unlocking lending capacity. We've clearly gone through a period where, you know, one problem has emerged and we've tried to address that in order to improve that market functioning, and then we found that problem sort of run off to a different part of the financial markets. When the auction rate securities market, you know, sort of ran into difficulties and the auctions weren't fully subscribed and the interest rates went up very high and people who had invested in short-term funds that they thought were money-like but now they were locked in, that was not really a new financial shock. It was a symptom of the, you know, unwillingness of certain financial institutions to apply funds to a market, which previously they thought was fine, but now all funds are scarce, and so I can't do this, I can't do this, and I can't fill out that auction. So it's, you know, these difficulties that arise in one market have a habit of finding their way into these other markets and generating lots of problems. It would have been very difficult to say, this is exactly what we're going to do. We're only going to do this, and it doesn't matter what the other developments are. We won't change our plan because this is what we, how we design this program. I think that the approach that was required needed flexibility. You know, I interpreted all of the discussions as, you know, wanting to bring flexible approaches to this, but, you know, I certainly couldn't speak to the particulars of how any one particular part of these programs were implemented.
Question here about insurance companies buying banks to get in on the Emergency Economic Stabilization Act funds.
Is that, I thought it was a question about that. Is
yeah.
that the question?
Are they going to? So I can't say that I fully understand or understood the ramification. So it is the case that the TARP funding has been directed to banks to inject capital into them. By providing them with more capital, the hope is that they will feel more comfortable with their balance sheet situation so that they will begin to make loans. I think that that is greatly challenged in the current environment because with the economic downturn, even if you had ample funds, you're more likely to question certain types of lending, and so it is certainly riskier. We are certainly undergoing a great transformation in the financial system. Earlier on, when the Treasury proposed a new look at the regulatory environment, there were different regulators for different entities, and as the Federal Reserve, when we began lending to investment banks, one question we had to deal with was the fact that we don't regulate investment banks directly, and we needed to have an eye into those institutions to feel like our lending was properly done and that we could monitor those risks. That problem has been resolved to some extent because those investment banks became bank holding companies, and so we naturally had an eye into them. Now more institutions are going that route. And this is something that I don't fully understand the great breadth of what the implications are, and we're going to have to study that going forward.
You know, some people have been concerned that this money from the Stabilization Act, the people keep writing bailout, by the way, is part of going to stronger banks to buy weaker banks as opposed to funding deals that ordinarily would have been workable. Many say that we're going to come out of this with fewer banks one way or another. Is this a preferable method for stabilizing the credit market?
Well, the banking system has gone through a large degree of consolidation over the last 10 years, certainly, and even longer. And we have moved to a system which some of my staff, researchers, and others have described as sort of a barbell system where you had a small number of very large banks and a large number of very small banks, community banks. And in between, the mid-sized regional banks were sort of looking for the right comparative advantage in order to stay there. And it was not unusual for them to be acquired or merged with others and join the larger size. This is certainly a case where the financial industry is changing very, very rapidly in ways that are almost unimaginable if you would step back 2 years ago and wondered what's it going to be like at the end of 2008. You would not have projected this. And so, you know, it's just almost impossible to think about it in that way.
You mentioned the relative strength of the U.S. dollar. With the global nature and the global nature of all the financial markets, how does a strong U.S. dollar play into all this and where we're going to end up and where do you think the dollar is going to end up in all this?
So I've been with the Federal Reserve since 1991. Somewhere along the line, I think I went to a school for about 2 weeks and they taught us that we never answer a question about the exchange rate. The official answer is that the dollar is the responsibility of the Treasury Department, and you know we don't impinge upon that. I don't talk about its valuation. I will say that changes in the dollar are something that we monitor at the Federal Reserve. We monitor the influence of those developments for how they affect inflationary pressures, because higher imported goods prices in large quantities would have a noticeable effect on inflation. And it's also the case that, changes in the dollar affect exports and that, and so we monitor it for pressures on the productive capacity of the U.S., but beyond that, I couldn't say more.
Okay, thanks. This interesting question, does the banking industry have a different view than Wall Street of what's good and bad right now?
I don't think I have an eye into that particular question. For quite some time,
Last fall 2007, we would get the Wall Street versus Main Street perspective. And if you talk to people in New York, certainly in the fall of 2007, in the speech I mentioned that, monetary policy has been very aggressive. We've been, I'd like to say we've been ahead of the curve. But in the fall of 2007, on Wall Street, they were saying we were behind the curve, that the futures market had, very large rate cuts embedded in them early on. And this was very difficult for people outside of Wall Street, directly in the know with all of the difficulties on what their valuations were for these mortgages. And credit was not really being adversely affected outside of the New York area. When I talked to bankers, people in the Midwest, they were able to get access to credit. And so this didn't seem to be a big problem. That was the fall of 2007. Now you get into the spring of this year and you get into Bear Stearns. Once you get the auction rate securities kind of dysfunction taking place, you began to hear more of the credit contraction type of issues. The senior loan officer survey that the Fed conducts quarterly, early this year in the first quarter, and I think even in the fourth quarter, began to say banks are tightening credit. And it's a directional survey, so, are you tightening or easing? No, we're not easing. We're tightening. But it might not be very much. But it's been tightening quite a lot in each and every survey since then. And we're well past the viewpoint that anybody is not affected by these financial difficulties. I can't say that they're once you start talking about how, funds are being injected into certain sectors of the economy, there are differences of opinion. It depends on, where they're going.
Last question. Saw some polls this week that President-elect Obama enjoys a lot of very high ratings, favorable ratings, and confidence coming into office. If you could give some advice to him on what he would spend his first 100 days doing for the economic crisis, what would you share with him?
I'm very hopeful about developments and forthcoming developments from, the new administration and people who have been working on this for quite some time. So, my advice would be to bring the best minds and the best thinking to bear on the toughest problems, certainly economically, that we have faced in decades. We are going to need that in order to solve these problems. The financial distress that is taking place right now is only one part of the problem. The other part of the another part of the problem is the housing situation and the very large inventory of unsold homes. And until we get some firmer feeling that market is going to stabilize with known prices, that's going to continue to put pressure on financial markets as to the valuation of those mortgage-related assets. How we get some type of firming on that is going to be a very, very big and important issue, and it's going to take the best thinking that we have on that. So I'm very hopeful about that, but it's a huge challenge.
Charles Evans, thank you for being with us here today.
That was Federal Reserve CEO Charles Evans. He spoke to the Economic Club earlier this month. Gary Dick is the president and managing editor of Grow Indiana Media Ventures and the creator and host of Inside Indiana Business. Dick says Indiana's economic situation is dismal, but in comparison to other states, we have some good things going on. That's especially true when it comes to areas like life sciences and relationships with foreign manufacturers. Dick also thinks that businesses need to get back to basics in 2009, which means watching growth and spending.
How are Indiana businesses weathering, really, this current economic downturn? I think the biggest thing I'm seeing around the state is uncertainty, obviously, and in many cases, a lot of fear. And I think it's well placed because we look nationally at where we are, whether it's the stock market, the unemployment rate, whatever the indicator is. We're in a recession. There's no question about that. And we heard this week that officially we've been in a recession for a year. Most people suggest it's going to get worse before it's going to get better. So there's uncertainty at best, fear in a worst case scenario around the state. What I think is interesting is the roller coaster ride that Indiana is on, while other states like Michigan and Ohio and other Midwestern states are really in the tank, there are some bright spots in the Indiana landscape. So, yes, we are seeing plants of varying sizes around the state close or cut down operations, but we're also seeing the new Honda plant, and we're seeing life sciences investment and distribution and logistics companies, and a lot of really positive things. And while our unemployment rate is up, compared to other states in the Midwest, we're doing as well, if not better, than other states. So while it is a tough environment and a tough economy in Indiana, there are some reasons. What is it about Indiana that makes it different? I don't know if you can put your finger on one particular thing, but I think if you look at several things, including a really aggressive economic development effort in the state, not focused on any particular area, but the state as a whole. You know, we're seeing investment from other parts of the country coming into the state. We're seeing Indiana continue to be a leader or one of the top states in the country for foreign direct investment. So whether it's Honda or Toyota or any Japanese-owned or affiliated companies, more and more are looking at Indiana as a place to do business. Why? Well, you look at the typical things, you know, cost of doing business, location, workforce, work ethic. But there's also another piece that I think companies are increasingly looking at, and that's the financial stability of the state itself. While most states in the country, let alone the Midwest, are in a deficit situation, Indiana has a budget surplus, which, you know, as a company, as you look to where you might want to invest, that is a real positive. So I think from that standpoint, and that has allowed Indiana to invest in transportation. You know, the Major Moves initiative, which in some parts of the state was a rather controversial initiative, has allowed the state to build and improve roads at a time when few other states are able to do that. And transportation is one of the key issues as businesses look to expand or grow their workforce. So I think all of those things have helped. Make no mistake about it, we're facing some serious challenges in education and funding. You know, we talk about a budget surplus. That's great, but with the economy in the year ahead and the pressures, you know, from a financial standpoint, it's going to be a tough 2009. I don't think there's any way to get around it.
That's Gary Dick of Inside Indiana Business. You've been listening to the Luncheon Speaker Series from the Economic Club of Indiana, recorded live in downtown Indianapolis. This month's speaker was Charles Evans, Chief Executive Officer of the Federal Reserve. Next month, leading brain drain expert Rebecca Ryan will address the club. Ryan has been aggressively studying the career patterns and motivations of young people for the past 10 years. Her firm, Next Generation Consulting, is at the forefront of the battle over talented young minds. This program is produced by Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations. I'm Mary Hartnett. Thanks for listening.
Proliance Energy, providing natural gas to more than 1,200 commercial, industrial, utility, and municipal customers. Proliance, adding power to energy. Information is at proliance.com.